Welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. We'd like to start off by saying thank you to Alan Weiner and the staff of WBCQ, the station that QSO is airing on right now, on 7415 kilohertz. We also want to remind you to go to the website, and that's at www.tedrandall.com. That's www.tedrandall.com, spelled TEDRANDALL.com. Last week, we had Dave Sparks on with us, N4OZO, and he was talking about the TW2010 antenna and what we were going to do with this I Work Dave thing. If you go up to the website, www.tedrandall.com, you'll see a little tab that says I Work Dave. I want you to click on that and read the details. But I'll tell you all about it right now. For those that are listening, Dave Sparks, N4OZO, is on the air with the TW2010. We want you to give him a call and listen. Now, not right now. Listen for N4OZO on the TW2010. And you can see a picture of the antenna on the website. If you work Dave, we're going to send you a QSL card from QSO. And TW Antennas will send you a I Work Dave certificate suitable for framing. Now listen for Dave on 17 meters, Sunday afternoons at 18.135. That's 18.135, you know, plus or minus a little noise or QSB. That's at 2 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Eastern, and 20 hours UTC. Once again, 2 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Eastern, and 20 hours UTC. Good luck and the best of luck working Dave. Dave's going to be listening for you. Now, if you work Dave, you'll become eligible for another contest soon to be announced from TW Antennas. As a QSO listener, if you would like confirmation of this radio broadcast, we'll be happy to send you a QSL card. All you have to do is write us at QSO, 2115 Leeville Pike. That's 2115 Leeville, spelled L-E-E-V-I-L-L-E. That's L-E-E-V-I-L-L-E, Pike, P-I-K-E, 2115 Leeville Pike, Lebanon, Tennessee. Lebanon spelled just like the country, Lebanon, Tennessee. The zip code is 37090. That's 37090. If you're a member of a local ham radio club or organization, and you're proud of something the organization has done, or if you know a local amateur in your area that has accomplished something outstanding, send us the information. We'll put it on the air. We love to talk about hams. You can send us the information by going to the website at www.tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com.
Wireless. You hear that word used a lot today. We have wireless telephones, wireless internet systems, wireless microphones. What it actually means is that they are radios. And who knows more about radios than amateur radio operators? Call them amateurs or call them hams. They know the modern wireless world. They helped create it.
Our guest today is Gordon West. And I must say that this gentleman has done a whole lot for the cause of ham radio. He's probably, I'm going to just say he's the world's foremost instructor as far as getting you a ham license or getting you a ticket. And I have a lot of admiration for this man because I happen to believe and I remain excited about the ham radio service. And how are you doing today, Gordon?
I'm fine, Ted. Thanks for having me on your show.
I would like to ask you, what motivated you into getting into the role of teacher with the wonderful CDs and books and things that you've put out that are so so easy to follow? What got you going on this track?
Probably my own interest in obtaining that first ham radio license and not having a local radio club to go to. So I thought, gee, I need some way of working through the different books that would keep me right on target and get me lined up to take that first entry exam, which back in the old days was, Ted, the novice ticket.
See, I remember getting the novice ticket, and I was in high school, and I couldn't wait to get home to fire up that single tube transmitter and get on and try to collect some QSL cards.
That's right, and you probably had your novice instructor. Remember, it was one person to give the novice test, so that instructor became your Elmer and your mentor, and he or she was usually there when you plugged in that first tube radio to give you a hand, a very shaky hand on CW getting on the air.
And I remember very well the first CW contact, because when I was on, everything was fine until the guy started transmitting back to me, and everything just ran together in my head. I was having such so nervous, had a difficult time. But, of course, that soon passes, you know, especially when you start getting two or three of those QSL cards in the mail. Tell me about your ham radio beginnings. How did you get into it? What sparked your interest in ham radio?
I was a shortwave listener and was actually taking part in two-way radio communications, a part of Class A Citizens Band, which back in the Class A day was on the current 460 megahertz band, 455, 460. And then Class D CB came along, and I had my first international crystal icebox CB radio, along with a pair of crystals. And I knew I wanted to do more because of the excitement of skywaves back in the peak of the solar cycle in 1957 and 58. So at that point, I went on to get my first novice call sign, and I transitioned from the excitement of CB radio over to ham radio.
Citizens Band radio was quite a bit different back then. Now, this was prior to 11 meters?
That's correct. Prior to 11 meters, they had a Class A CB radio service, and we had Vocaline transceivers, and you would change the frequency, Ted, by pushing with a pencil eraser these two plates, capacitive VFO, you might say. And it was short range, maybe 1 or 2 watts out, and it was designed for the utility of staying in touch with someone, not just as a hobby. And then Class D came along, and Class D immediately was embraced by the hobbyists, and I think at that point the FCC realized that they had a tiger by the tail, in that folks that came to Class D, 27 megahertz CB radio, were sort of like beginner hams, and many quality hams have risen up from the ranks of Class D Citizens Band.
And basically, really, that's where I came from. And there were some pretty strange rules, if you look at it now. I believe it was channels 1 through 8, and then channel 15 through 22. You could only speak to your own base or your own mobile or one of the units that you were licensed to. And
yep.
then I think it was channels 9 through 14 that allowed you to talk to other licensed CBers, but you could only talk for 5 minutes, and then you had to observe a 5-minute silent period before you could say anything else, and you could only 4 watts and nothing over, I think it was 150 miles. Am I remembering that all correctly?
Oh, I think you do. And many of us abided by those rules, but we wanted to do more than 150 miles, and we wanted to talk to more than just family and friends. So that's where ham radio was the next logical stepping stone.
Of course, now, ham radio existed all along, right alongside that service. Ham radio was always available. But, you know, I think that it was somewhat elusive to a lot of people. I think the Citizens Band made a good introduction.
It did. Ham radio was like that secret radio service that you would ultimately be invited to join the secret ranks and become a ham operator. And to become a ham, you first had to start with the novice license, and that required both a code test as well as a written test, and that required you finding another ham that would send away for your test paperwork. So it was a big step to join ham radio, and it was an easy step to become a licensed CB radio operator, because at the very beginning, as you recall, Ted, we had to have a call sign with our CB station, 11W2534. You remember those days.
I remember those call signs. However, at my entry point. I think they were all using things like KPN, KRN, KNN. They were using those kind of letters followed by four numbers.
That's correct. That was the second phase of call signs. The very first phase was the FCC districts, and 11W was Southern California, 9W, I think, was Chicago, and 7W was Florida. But now then they went to KMX and KMY, and then they finally just abolished call letters altogether.
I remember my first taste of ham radio. I was in Detroit, Michigan, and I went to a ham's house. My mom had taken me there. He went to church with my aunt, I think. And I walked in, and his name was Nelson Cosby. He was from Dearborn, Michigan. And he had a Heathkit Marauder and an SX-101 and a homebrew pair of 813s. I'll never forget this station, because when he turned on the amplifier, there was a big light bulb that came on and lit up brightly, and then it kind of dimmed out. Of course, we all know now that was in the power supply, but to me, it was like witchcraft. I didn't know what was going on. And he had mercury vapor tubes that had that romantic purple hue to them as he talked. He had a beam, and the only contact he made was a gentleman in Denver, Colorado. I just remember him talking to Denver, and when I saw this guy talking to Denver, Colorado, sitting in his basement Radio Shack, I was hooked. There was nothing else I could do. I became paralyzed by the hobby from that point on. Did you have a similar circumstance at all?
Oh, I did. With CB radio, I had a shortwave receiver, a good old Hallicrafters S38E, and that radio was sort of a shocker, you might say, in that you never wanted to operate it in a wet environment, because one side of the chassis was hot. So if you completed the circuit, you knew you had a Hallicrafters S38E. But anyway, that allowed me to tune in to the 40-meter ham bands and listen to some of the CW, as well as just swinging over to single sideband as well as double sideband AM. And hearing those hearing the folks talk Skywave, that was exciting. That's what hooked me, Skywave.
Yeah, I had an old Gruno, and back then, of course, it was AM days. And you would tune into the hams talking on 40 meters, because that little receiver did really well. And it was so fascinating to hear these guys just sit there and rag chew. And they would talk about everything under the sun, and every once in a while one would break in, and he'd be in a different city. And it was like being caught away into another world, is what it was like. It was a doorway, you know, actually to the entire world. And as a kid, boy, I mean, your imagination would just go wild, because you could picture what this guy looked like and where he was sitting and all that. You know, it was really a theater of the mind. So now, when you first got your ham license, you first got your novice ticket. Tell me a little bit about that. How did that work out?
It worked out well. I went over to a fellow's TV repair shop, and he gave me the novice test and gave me a reasonable code test. He sent me a transmission. I can't quite remember every word, but it had words like volcano to be sure and use the letter V and the L and the C, which are a little bit more complex than some of the other ones. But I copied that 5 words a minute. And he sent away for my call sign, and boy, it seemed like the longest wait. I think it was about 30 days to finally get my call letters from the Federal Communications Commission. And once I had the call letters, I was on with a Heathkit, HW101, and pounding away on the CW bands as a novice operator with other operators all over the country.
Well, did you ever get one of the worked all state certificates and all those sort of things?
You know, some folks were really into working all states and working all countries and things like that. And while I enjoyed exchanging QSL cards, I never really got into the competition side of thing. If I did, I would have probably been hooked. But no, I just enjoyed working as many new places as possible and had a great time talking with old friends via CW. So never really went into trying to earn the worked all states.
Well, I think that's the way I was. My problem was, is I was too excited at just about making contacts and collecting cards to be able to concentrate on trying to work all states, because I'd hear a station in there, and NECQ to me was fascinating, because I figured that's another postcard for the wall, if that makes
that's
any sense.
That's right.
So the novice ticket, you know, let me ask you this. I mean, today we live in an age of, oh boy, we have some technology that's unbelievable right now. And I see all of these things. You know, I'm wondering, do you think we've lost anything? Have we kind of lost a little bit of that magic of the novice license and the little low-power tube transmitters and that sort of thing? How do you see that?
Well, I think the magic that is no longer magic but easily seen is wireless. And when we first started off with radio, and for those listeners to your show right now, hearing us via skywaves and hearing a little bit of the skywaves fading in and out, that is magic. But so many folks have grown accustomed to wireless that they're no longer going to be a candidate for our ham radio magic, because they really don't care about how the signal goes from one cell site to the other, or from their Wi-Fi to their local router. To me, that is magic. I always get a kick out of stuff that goes wireless. But for today's generation, we've probably lost half of our potential ham radio customers, because they're not turned on with getting a signal that is coming in and out of the ionosphere via this magic of propagation without having to use repeaters.
Well, you know, I think the thing of it is that you know, we have gotten computers. I mean, you can sit down with an instant message. You can talk on it. You can do all these things. But you're dependent on that infrastructure. I mean, you've got to be connected to a connection that you're paying dearly for. And you're always at their mercy, because at any moment, you know, that connection can go away, and then you sit there and you don't have anything. You are dead in the water.
That is true. But we have grown so accustomed to turning on the light switch and the lights come on, or grabbing the cell phone or the BlackBerry or the Q phone, that we just take for granted it's always going to be there. And as our communication systems for commercial communications become more and more sophisticated, we just take it for granted. But it's the hams that look into the crystal ball and see that when the big hurricane comes, or here in Southern California, the big earthquake, those comm systems could fail. And then, of course, we're back to truly wireless without the need of repeaters, and that's where ham radio operators will shine, if we have any operators left still shining.
We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with Gordon West right after this.
We've got something special for you. TW Antennas, your DX adventure, has got a special going on right now. You can now save on shipping when you buy the complete TW 2010 Traveler Antenna Combo. Now, the complete package includes the TW 2010 Antenna, the Quadrupad, and the Deluxe Transport Bag. You have to see this. Go to the website and check this out. It's a complete package plus $50 savings on shipping. The complete package is $549.85. That's $549.85. But check it out on the website. Go and look at twantennas.com. And if you can't find that, go to our website. And that's tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, for the QSO radio program. And check out the TW Antenna Special right now on QSO.
We're back, and our guest is Gordon West. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, your beginnings and getting into ham radio, but you're involved in some other things, and I'm going to talk about Gordon West just a little bit. Tell me a little bit about this adventure, I'm going to call it, that you're going to be doing here within the next few weeks. You're doing some missionary work, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Well, as you know, there are still many areas of the world, Ted, that have no infrastructure of modern communications. And ham radio for sailors out at sea certainly is one of the big turn-ons, because they can stay in touch via ham radio email with loved ones back home without having to rely on satellites. Certainly, satellites, as we get more and more satellites up, will ultimately lead us to a worldwide cell phone that will work anywhere, including in the middle of the ocean. But right now, except for Iridium, There is no cell phone that literally works the world way out in the middle of nowhere. And two-way radio is still relied on by the doctors and nurses on some remote islands called the Line Islands. They're at 1 degree north, due south of Hawaii, right on the equator. And I'm specifically going back to Kiritimati Island, known as Christmas Island, and then via a small boat working north to Fanning Island and further north to Washington Island. These outposts interconnected via marine VHF radio and the country's high-frequency 7.4 megahertz communication system. And so I'll be there for 2.5 weeks playing almost ham radio, but marine VHF and commercial radio on high frequency to bounce signals off the ionosphere or within the troposphere to keep these islands connected to the outside world and among themselves.
Now, how does all that infrastructure work? I mean, how does that physically take place?
We first had to get permission from the host country of Christmas Island to be able to support these communications, and they gave us permission to use different radio frequencies. We were fortunate that marine VHF carries very well at 156 megahertz down near the equator via tropoducting over a couple of hundred miles. And as your listeners, Ted, know, VHF propagation normally goes 20 to 30 miles, but over the warm seawater, it goes literally 100 miles plus. Propagation via high frequency will be on 7.4 megahertz, and our propagation there will reach out 300 to 400 miles. And being a ham radio operator, it's much like the 40-meter ham band when it comes to propagation. So the equipment is all transistorized, everything running on solar panels, and everything tied into storage batteries that we're bringing down via boat to these islands.
And what type of, now in this situation, what type of communication is exchanged over this network that you're working on?
They have one and only hospital at Christmas Island that is frequented by mariners aboard boats passing through the island chain to get to Tonga. And this is the only rest stop, you might say, on the equator for any medical help. They have one doctor, and they have a good cadre of nurses, well-trained nurses, that will treat both visitors as well as their own islanders for just about anything with just rudimentary equipment. X-ray? No, I don't think so, because there's very little alternating current on the island, because these were the same islands involved in the H-bomb tests in the 50s, so everything was buried underground, and of course, seawater has now seeped into the atoll's ground level and has shorted those all out. So pretty much everything is off solar panels and batteries to keep the hospital in touch with the four or five clinics on Christmas Island, the five clinics on Fanning Island, and as I'll soon find out next week, the three or four clinics left on Washington Island.
How did you get involved in this project to start with? This sounds like it's a real cool thing to get involved in.
Well, again, as many of us in the communications field will say, ham radio. I had a ham radio friend that was talking to me about what frequencies would be good for this and that, and then I found out he was volunteering his time to bring over medications and was going to bring CB radios on 27 megahertz because that's what they had used in the past. And I said, gee, I think we can probably do better than Citizens Band, and CB might not even be allowed in the Christmas Island chain. So we finally got permission to operate sideband and VHF, but it was a fellow ham that invited me to join in this all-volunteer effort.
That's fantastic. That's really, really cool. I commend you. And this is the kind of thing, folks, that that makes a great name for amateur radio and makes us good neighbors, not just domestically here in the United States, but all over the world. And that's what gives us, I guess I want to say, that creates the respect that people have for ham radio. You know, I don't want to jump the gun, but I would like to ask you, because you teach
these classes in on the CD and whatnot. You have a school. Tell me a little bit about the school. Now, how does that work? Now, I've heard about the Gordon West School. So tell me about the Gordon West School.
I started offering ham radio classes about the same time that I came out with some training materials, loose leaf held together by a comb binding that my wife Susie, also a ham N6GLF, she and I would put these together on our dining room table and issue them to fellow folks back in the 60s wanting to get their ham ticket. And I thought, you know, maybe the local junior colleges would like to offer some ham radio courses. So I went through the college system and found out that they wanted ham instruction. So started teaching ham radio classes through the local community college system, and then started offering upgrade classes on our own. And then we started bringing out some good quality books by a book publisher that recognized the need for additional training materials. And it ended up as Gordon West Radio School. And my wife and I are the sole proprietors. And we have literally thousands of hams that we have trained throughout the world that we're so proud of, because more than just getting a license, Ted, they're on the air contributing to the hobby and service of ham radio.
Well, you know, that's another thing I wanted to bring up to you, and that is, you know, you are really, really big on being an Elmer and advocating that people become Elmers. Why is that so important? Why do you see Elmers as being something that people should be getting? Let's define what an Elmer is, and then let's talk about what it takes to become one.
Well, that's a great question that you ask, and I know your readers who are shortwave listeners tuning in to us at 9480 kilohertz and 5755 kilohertz. Did I get those frequencies right, Ted?
That's correct.
Oh, good. All right. I want to make sure I'm getting the right numbers here. When we obtain our ham radio license in the years past, we would take it in front of a single ham who would become our Elmer. And an Elmer is a name for someone that teaches someone all about a specific hobby and brings them up through the ranks. Now the examination system, which is running very well, is run by three ham radio operators that have either the general or the extra class license. They are credentialed by the volunteer examination system as volunteer examiners. They're accredited. And these examiners offer free of charge, other than the $14 test fee that some charge to make up expenses, tests once a week, once a month. But they have so many applicants that they really don't have a chance to take one or two of the applicants under their wings. So someone that's been studying my materials or the American Radio Relay League fine materials, they go to the test, they take the test, they pass the test, and they say, congratulations, welcome to ham radio. And they stumble out of the test room and about a week later end up with call sign. And the next question is, what's next? And here's the thing is, they don't know. Unless they have an Elmer that will take them by the hand saying, well, you should first get started on maybe 2 meters and 440 megahertz and meet some of the local hams and join a ham radio club, they're lost. They're licensed, but they're lost. So the importance of an Elmer is to be right there saying, okay, you've got step one, that's the license. Now let's talk about getting you on the air.
Well, you know, and you know, procedures scared me when I first got into ham radio. I was afraid of the procedures. I was afraid of traffic handling. Talk a little bit about that, because it's not that complex, but is that not a hurdle? Does that not frighten some people?
You know, I think it does, procedures of going on the air. So what we do in our classes, and these are usually weekend classes, is we have the students home study ahead of time with home study materials that we make available to them. Then they take the class, and within the class we have operating equipment where they learn to speak over the microphone and so on. But you know, once they pass the test and they know how to talk on the mic, they have a huge hurdle, and that hurdle is going to the ham store or the ham catalogs, ordering a piece of equipment, and then figuring out how to start programming it and how to put in the popular repeater channels, where they don't know what's popular in their area unless they had an Elmer right there to help them pre-program the radio.
So in other words, it's no longer just dip the plate and peak the grid.
No longer dip the plate, peak the grid, up the load, and watch the SWR. Nope, now it is put the antenna up, dual band antenna on the vehicle or a nice fiberglass dual band on the rooftop. But then figuring out how to program the output, what the input separation is, what the subaudible tone is, all of these are important steps. And worse yet is knowing what output to tune in and what is the popular repeater for their specific area. Many ham stores, almost all ham stores, will sell the equipment and let the student walk out of the store with this brand new piece of equipment, dual band radio under their arm. But they failed to say, let me put in a couple of channels that I know will get you turned on to some of the local clubs than their meeting time. So that's my big push right now is let's do more for these brand new licensed hams. Let's not just sell them a piece of gear and saying, good luck, but rather help them pre-program it before they leave that facility and get them on the air.
Well, you know, I think it goes back to the simple thing of programming a VCR years ago. I had to have my kids do it. I'm looking right now at a dual band rig sitting on my desk that's got cross repeat on it. It's a 2 meter 440, and I've had it on a couple times, and I've managed to get into a QSO or hit a repeater with the thing, but I still haven't got the slightest idea how to take advantage of all the features of this radio. And it's pretty complex. I mean, when you think about how it'll do, now the worst thing in the world is I have a little THF6 that my son gave me, and that's a fantastic little radio. It's three bands, but, you know, I need to carry a little pocket guide or something with me in order to find my way around. But you know what? He gets on the thing, and it scans, finds the PL tones. He knows exactly what's going on, and I sit there, and I just stare dumbfounded, thinking to myself, when am I going to learn all this stuff?
Well, that's a good point. You know, kids, we teach free kids classes each summer. Kids really pick this stuff up. But again, here in Southern California, we've got so many different repeaters to choose from. We know which one kids will like. In fact, we have some that have kids' nets in the evenings on the weekends. So those are the ones that we would like kids to start listening to so they can really jump in with both feet. But unless they know the frequency, the offset, the subaudible tone, the time for the nets, when to talk, a little procedure, they're not going to fit in well. So that's the importance of a ham radio Elmer after the student has their brand new call sign.
Sounds like I'm still needing an Elmer. What do you think?
Well, you know, when I give this talk at different ham fests, you see some of these hams in the front row going, oh, yeah, you just must be dumb. You don't know how to program a radio. So I take out a current radio, and I say, oh, by the way, would you mind putting in 146.82-600 with the 103.5 PL? And they go, well, So even the old-timers, even those that think they know every radio, may have a hard time because each radio programs differently. And if the hams can't figure it out that have been around for years, think about the brand-new ham that just passed the test, walked home with their brand-new Kenwood Yaesu Icom or a Linko or Radio Shack radio. They don't know what frequency to program because nobody has put their arm around them and saying, welcome to ham radio. Let me help you program the radio.
That's a thing I want to say that everybody ought to take note. It you know, find some new ham. If you're already a ham, find somebody and extend your hand because that's what made ham radio what it is today. Or had that benevolent camaraderie, whatever you want to call it. It's almost like a fellowship. And I'm thinking of a word, but I can't come up with it. That has made ham radio and given it the reputation that it has. Fraternity, that's the word I want, fraternity. Let's take a break. We'll be back with Gordon West right after this.
As a QSO listener, if you would like confirmation of this radio broadcast, we'll be happy to send you a QSL card. All you have to do is write us at QSO, 2115 Leeville Pike. That's 2115 Leeville, spelled L-E-E-V-I-L-L-E. That's L-E-E-V-I-L-L-E. Pike, P-I-K-E. 2115 Leeville Pike, Lebanon, Tennessee.
Lebanon spelled just like the country, Lebanon, Tennessee. The zip code is 37090. That's 37090.
We're back, and our guest is Gordon West. We've talked a little bit about the schools and the study material. Gordon, tell me about all the different facets of ham radio. We've got shortwave listeners, and some of them sitting on the edge of their seats, and they're saying, you know, I'd kind of like to get into that. But now there's so many different things going on. What are the things that you find the most fascinating about the hobby today?
Probably the most fascinating are the different modes that a new ham operator can get involved in. And I find each of the modes fascinating, and I encourage all of our students, don't get stuck in just one mode. From amateur television for the video modes to packet radio, PacTor, SciTor, and the many telex over radio modes, PSK31, working meteors automatically, nearly automatically with a computer, so many different modes beyond just FM voice for 2 meters and 440, and single sideband on high frequency, as well as the very popular mode, CW, that when they did away with the code test, people called Gordo up saying, oh boy, you're never going to sell any more code tapes. We are moving more code materials now to our students than we did before the CW test at the FCC level was eliminated. So many modes, and we tell all of our students, stay absolutely tuned into all of them and pick your favorite, but don't get set, move on to more modes.
Well, you know what? Describe something for me here. You mentioned working meteors by computer control. I've never heard of this.
Oh, sure. Meteor scatter work used to be done using voice. In fact, on some of my audio courses, we have excerpts of me talking through meteors, and the conversations are very quick, such as WB6 Fenway Delta Mike 13, S3, and that's it, gone. That was a whole conversation. Now we're able to, through the computer, fire up relatively fast packets of information and do a handshake and get a confirmation back from another ham, almost automated, where you let the computer do the work and you just sit right there in front of it as a control operator. You don't even hear what's going on the air.
Well, you know, you mentioned all these other modes, and of course, there some of them are data. You know, I play, well, I don't want to tell this. I'm going to tell it. I remember playing with a Model 15.
Teletype.
Teletype machine, and I remember all of the pictures that these hams would exchange of all kinds of things, from beautiful women to the face of presidents. And
it was tough to do pictures, Ted, when we had to do them with the letters Ks and Js and Vs and Zs and periods and commas, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But talk about all this new data stuff. What can a ham do? A new guy gets his license, and he's gonna get into, packet or packed, or how do all these modes work? Describe this a little bit.
Well, if your shortwave listeners on our shortwave broadcast today are into computers, there are a number of computer software decode programs that, without having to get a ham license, you can begin to take part in them. And these decode programs will begin to decode one mode is PSK31, which sounds just like a whistle on 14.070, but that whistle turns into be a meaningful conversation between a couple of hams. Many of these digital modes will fight through the noise better than either CW as well as voice. So the digital modes really have their place. But, of course, you have to have the computer to generate and to decode what your transceiver, your ham transmitter receiver, is getting on the airwaves.
So if you're sitting with your computer, and, of course, most of the younger people today are computer savvy, and marrying the computer to ham radio, as far as I can see, is destiny. That's the thing that's going to take this thing into the next level. Being able to couple these things, to be able to embrace the simplicity of throwing a dipole in a tree and firing up a generator on field day and making contacts all over the world You know, like, look, Ma, no hands. We have no infrastructure, and we're talking all over the world. Taking that technology of years ago and marrying it now to the new computer technology, that brings a combination of things that goes beyond the imagination.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And for some kids, it's a big turn-on being able to do this in an area where their cell phone or their BlackBerry does not work because they're too far out in the bush to make it work. Ham radio, of course, is able to take these signals and many times bounce them off the ionosphere and come back down thousands of miles away. But many times, a small little handheld radio, Ted, going through an IRLP, Internet Radio Linking Project system, you access your local with a handheld IRLP repeater, and magically, you're speaking with ham radio operators also with a handheld in New York City, Tampa, Florida, Saskatchewan, Anchorage, Alaska, and maybe Antarctica, thanks to the computers that are handling this traffic on the Internet, yet bringing it back out onto the Internet Radio Linking Project. And there's also EchoLink, there's Wires, many computer-supported ham radio systems, including the latest D-Star from ICOM America that allows digital signals once they enter into the ham radio system.
Well, you know, now I'm going to step back here a minute, but I've heard talk on the air, especially on the HF frequencies, where hams will say things, now that EchoLink, that's just not ham radio. Now, what do you think about that?
It's certainly EchoLink and IRLP talking on a handheld to another station thousands of miles away. It certainly is not high frequency where the signals are bounced off the ionosphere. I absolutely agree. So for some, it is not really ham radio, taking a shower with all your clothes on. However, for someone getting started in ham radio, it certainly is a lot more exciting when your local repeater on the mountaintop 25 miles away magically takes your signal into the Internet and conveys it to another station thousands of miles away with complete clarity, sometimes clarity better than a worldwide context. So it's not the same. But again, I always tell our students, before you say, this is not good, yeah, this is good, stay open-minded for all the new technology that hams can do.
Well, one of the things I can equate this to, we go back to Elmer's and we go back to all these things. When I was a kid, when I was very young, I lost my dad when I was like 11 years old. And I was an only child. I was with my mom. And after being exposed to ham radio, I was attending a church out on the west side of Detroit, and they wanted all of us, a group of us young folks, to go look at a school down in Texas. So we went on a school bus, and we went from, I think it was the Detroit area, down to Dallas to look at a school. And this pastor was aware of some ham radio equipment that they had at the school that was not being used, and he was vying to get this in my hands, and he wound up doing it. And it was an old Globe Champ 300 and a Hallicrafters SX-100.
Wow, and, good gear back then.
Yeah, so I had this station set up. His name was Weldon Spracklin. He was a Baptist preacher on the west side of Detroit, and this is where my mom took me to church. And it changed my life. Once I had that equipment, I was, the whole world was my bedroom. I mean, when I walked into my room, only child, once again, you know, when I went into that bedroom, buddy, I'll tell you what, it was everywhere. You know, I mean, it was a magical kingdom. By means of tubes and wires. And that technology, the simple things that I learned, stayed with me my entire life and provided a background when I got into commercial broadcast radio that was unequaled. I mean, I have friends of mine that wound up with degrees that still didn't have the practical grasp, you know, that I had from just playing and learning, you know. Now I have two sons. One is 26, the other one is 22. The older son is chief engineer for the Tribeca Nazarene University here in Nashville. The other one works for Dave Ramsey, the financial guru, and he's chief engineer for that group of people there. And both of them are ham operators, and both of them have learned incredible amounts from being involved in ham radio, hands-on, as well as now the IT end of it. And what I would like to suggest is, like Echolink, these younger people get immediately familiar with what a router is, what IP addresses are, what proxy means, what all these different terminology, all these things about IT is now being embraced in the ham radio hobby. And if they learn this stuff early on, they're going to take that with them for the rest of their life. And it provides a background that's just unequaled. There is nothing else I don't think a college education can compare, even though a college education is great and it's needed. It can't do what the experience in ham radio can do. Now, am I correct in saying this, or would you disagree with me?
No, I would absolutely agree. In fact, to add that when I first got started in ham radio, one of my first contacts was with a fellow named Bob Miller, and we would communicate regularly. And then one day he said, why don't you call me on the phone? So I called him on the phone, and he says, have you ever thought about taking your training to the next level with a book? And this is when we had just our informal materials that Susie and I came up with. And it turned out that Bob Miller, my ham radio contact, was the vice president of merchandising at Radio Shack. And he was able to get all of my ham radio books into Radio Shack and helped me go from what was just a homebrew book to a real live book that Radio Shack sold for nearly 25 years quite successfully before they dropped out of the shortwave and ham radio field. So just the contacts that our shortwave listeners listening to your show today, Ted, can make by speaking with others in ham radio, they'll probably find that these contacts will pan out to be good opportunities for advancement for the future.
Well, why I think what you're doing is so important is because when I was young, I had to struggle to learn the stuff because the books weren't written real well. Some of the information was confusing, especially to a young person that doesn't know anything about it. But to track this thing, if we go back to my early beginnings, and I can just use myself as an example because that's the only example I have, is I can go back to Pastor Weldon Spracklin taking me to Texas and putting some ham gear in my hands. Nelson Cosby, the fellow in Dearborn where I saw the first contact. And then I sit back and I watch my son driving down the I-65 freeway with some friends from where he works down to do a missionary project in Florida. And he's got his notebook connected up to his BlackBerry. He has internet access. And he's talking to me over a local repeater here in Nashville through Echolink. And I'm thinking, this has come full circle. You see, I mean, it's amazing. And I would so much encourage people to see the magic in this hobby. I don't think there's anything else, I can't think of anything else, that where you can learn so much and meet so many people that are just basically really good folks. And I know growing up, I was also mentored by the folks in Detroit that ran the Motor City Radio Club, W8MRM, and they used to have their meetings in the Greenfield Village Henry Ford Museum right in the radio section.
Wow.
And that was an amazing thing. It really was. You'd go in there and you could just, it was hard to pay attention to the meeting because you were busy looking at all the apparatus, around. You were almost expected a Tesla to jump up out of a corner somewhere. Anyways.
Well, that's a good point, and we encourage all of your listeners to join a radio club, a ham radio club, and expect that radio club will offer you many different areas to get involved with ham radio.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Gordon West right after this.
Do you suffer from the heartbreak of brain rot, feeling bored, sluggish, listless, not had a new idea in days, using electronic gizmos without a clue why they work? Now there's help. Ham radio, guaranteed to stimulate your corroding neurons and open a whole new world of excitement. To learn more about ham radio, go to helloradio.org.
Side effects of ham radio usage include mental stimulation, desire for education, new career paths, understanding of technology, and cases of addiction have been reported. If you experience any of these symptoms, you're welcome.
Ham radio. It's not your granddaddy's radio anymore.
We're back, and our guest is Gordon West. I would have to say the world's foremost instructor when it comes to amateur radio. You talked about local clubs. There's also the American Radio Relay League. the ARRL.
That is our largest and one most only nonprofit club for ham radio.
Tell me a little bit about your affiliation with the league, because I know you're active in supporting the league and being part of what they do.
The American Radio Relay League publishes terrific ham radio books. In fact, that's how I learn regularly about new modes, is to read all of the new books that they present. The ARRL is the nation's number one and truly the only nonprofit organization with representatives in Washington to help fight for our ham radio rights to have a nice, clean airwaves to tune in. And I know your shortwave listeners will appreciate all that the ARRL has done to minimize the effects of broadband over power line, a huge noise-generating system that literally puts computer noise directly on the power lines that radiate to their antennas. ARRL does so much for ham radio. So what my relationship with them is to be a good friend and encourage all of my students to join the American Radio Relay League, and also to be one of their registered instructors, and just an ambassador for ham radio, trying to work as closely as possible with the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut.
Of course, there's their station, W1AW, and they still do code practice and bulletins, and it's always fascinating every time you hear that call sign coming across.
Oh, it is, and my heart always beats a little faster realizing this is coming from the number one radio station in the country, W1AW. For all that the league does, and they're outreaching, especially into space, to get kids more involved into the space program via ham radio in the International Space Station and aboard most of the space shuttle missions. So ARRL, certainly our organization to represent us as ham radio operators throughout the world.
You know, I want to talk a minute or two here about the training. And let's say I've got a shortwave listener right now, which I know I do, and I know you're there, and you're saying, you know, I've been putting it off, but I really would love to get into ham radio. Let's talk about the first entry-level license, and tell us a little bit about your study material that they could get their hands on that would make life a lot easier.
The first license is now the technician class, Element 2. And that requires studying a pool of about 400 questions and answers with a multiple choice 35 exam test at the conclusion of your study. And the technician class license is a powerful one, allowing operators all access to frequencies above 50 megahertz and voice on a small portion of the 28 megahertz 10-meter band, as well as CW on 15, 40, and 75 meters, even though there is no CW Morse code test. So the tech license, called technician, is what gives brand-new operators for ham radio onto the airways, working right alongside with those that may have the extra or the general license. And the tech license just requires studying the questions and then going to take the 35-question multiple-choice exam, where you could miss up to 9 out of those 35 questions. But the biggest problem are not the questions and answers and learning them. It's just knuckling down, taking the study, and motivating yourself to ultimately show up at the examination center to take your relatively straightforward test. $14 is the test fee, and some don't even charge that, and then finding a local ham club to begin operating. So my programs are motivational, where I have audio CDs that play the different sounds of ham radio, especially to the International Space Station and working meteors and talking ionospheric skip on 6 meters. So I'm sort of motivational. Come on, you can do it. You can get that license.
Where can these study materials be found? Where can we look on the web and find these things?
All of our ham radio materials are now sold by ham radio dealers. Radio Shack, which used to sell all of ham radio materials, including the league materials, has pretty well concentrated on cellular materials now, not ham radio. But they can go to our main dealer distributor or any one of our dealers, and our main distributor is at www.w5yi.org. That's Whiskey 5 Yankee India, W5YI.org. That's a call sign of the founder of the W5YI organization, and see all of the different materials that are available.
Now, you've got the study guide for the technician, but you also have, for those hams that want to upgrade, you've got the general class study guide. You also have the extra class study guide. And these CDs, I can tell you firsthand, are just wonderful. They really are. They're humorous. You chuckle. You learn. And they're entertaining, for heaven's sakes. They really are. They're not just, it isn't just sitting there drilling away at a book. And for people like me, it's kind of cool to listen to the CD and follow along in the book at the same time, because they go hand in hand. They're just almost, they're replicated, I guess. Are they not?
Well, they are, and I appreciate hearing that. What we've done in our books is we reorganize the questions so that they're in a logical learning order. And instead of subjecting the brand new applicant to volts and watts and amps and ohms, we give them the lure of ham radio and propagation. So we've moved some of the questions around, and the CDs then play them the different sounds of tropospheric ducting and ionospheric skip and low-band ground wave propagation. So they hear this live and direct. And I do these CDs. You'll appreciate this, Ted, and many of your listeners at their shortwave stations probably have a little recording set up at their house. And that's, we do them right here at the house. Susie and I block off the phones, bring down the Heil microphones, and begin recording them. And I've got all the radio sounds right here, plus all sorts of audio files that we mix in. And it's a homebrew job, but then it's professionally digitized by a CD maker. And folks get a big kick out of them, because I enjoy poking a little bit of fun at some of the hilarious sounds that many times will intercept over the airwaves.
We're just about out of time, but there was two things that I wanted to cover. The first thing was, is the technician license does indeed give the operator some CW privileges on HF. That is the case then.
Yes, that is relatively new, but the new technician class licensee is encouraged to try CW on 10 meters, 15 meters, 40 meters, and 75 meters. They've reallocated some of the areas for the CW, and there's a lot of tech operators who have never passed a CW test but are doing great on Morse code dots and dashes down on high frequency.
The other question was, I was going to ask you about the upgrade to the general test. I understand that that question pool is either going to change or just recently changed. Which is it, and how much more difficult is the general class going to be?
It actually got easier. It changed last July 1st, and they took out some of the questions that people would stumble on because the answers were sort of nebulous. They added some more up-to-date questions on digital. So the general is no harder to pass than in the years past. And since there's no code test, no 5-word, no 13-word-a-minute code test associated with the general, the upgrade is study 400-plus questions, get at least no more than 9 wrong, and you pass the multiple-choice written exam. And you get immediate privileges when you upgrade from tech to general.
Is there any changes coming up in the extra class pool that you know of?
Yes, the extra is going to change next year, 2008, July 1st. The extra is going to be refined. Right now it's a conglomeration of the old advanced, the old extra. There's some general stuff in there. It's really a mismatch of a ton of questions, 800 plus, of which 50 are on the test. Right now, a question pool committee, including myself, are working on upgrading those questions to make much more sense. So I don't think the test will be any harder, but we won't know until we see the new completed pool early next year.
Well, very good. Now, your website for Gordon West Schools is what? Now, let's have that address real quick.
Just all one big long word, GordonWestRadioSchool.org. And Susie and I, we're always here, and we're one of the only schools. In fact, I think we're the only ham school in the country, but it's just a mom-and-pop organization, and my phone number, the same number you called me on, is published in all of our books and given out on the CDs. So we tell our students, hey, you got a question, or if you just passed your test and you need an Elmer, give me a phone call, and I'll talk directly with you during daylight hours here in California. And every day we get calls from our readers or those listening to us like you do, and it makes life very much fun for ham radio.
Okay, we have GordonWestSchools.com.
Almost, GordonWestRadioSchool.com,
okay,
all one word.
Make that right. Gordon West Radio School, or schools, plural, which is it now?
School.org,
okay,
O-R-G.
So it's GordonWestRadioSchool.org. We want to make sure we got this URL correct. GordonWestRadioSchool.org. And then
yep.
The URL for the your distributor that does is the
W5YI.org. W5YI.org.
Just want to encourage folks, this is a good way, an enjoyable way, to get into the hobby or upgrade. Mr. West, thank you so much for being on board with us. We're out of time, and we want to have you back sometime real soon.
Thanks again, Ted, and listeners out there, thank you for listening.
You've been listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. We thank you for joining us, and if you'd like more information about QSO, be sure to go to the website, www.tedrandall.com. That's www, spelled TEDRANDALL.com. We'll be back next week, same time, same station, with QSO.